Hello, I'm John Callender, and this is the Lies.com podcast for Friday, January 20th, 2006. I apologize, I missed last week's podcast. I'd sort of fallen into the habit of recording them on Fridays on my way into work. And this past Friday, our company was moving offices over the weekend, so they closed early. And my boss, Steve, graciously said I should work from home that day, so I did. So, no podcast last week. But Friday works out pretty well as a day for me to record the podcast because I then have the weekend, which these days is pretty much my only free time, to go through it and delete all the long pauses while I try and think of something to say. I was thinking the other day about perspective and perspective on Bush's presidency and the Iraq War. You know, occasionally now I'll go and look at all the weblogs that I pretty much was following every day when I was weblogging on lies.com more often. And I see these interesting stories that I know I would have been obsessing about, you know, just a few months ago. But without the time to give them their proper obsessive attention, you know, I just kind of see them and write them off as, oh yeah, okay. Another case of illegal spying, or another case of torture coming to light, more details about torture as an instrument of government policy under the Bush administration. Or another case of, like with this missile attack in Afghanistan, you know, another case of basically taking this war on terror metaphor and, you know, continuing the process of making it a real war with a president who has real wartime powers to, you know, do things like kill random civilians on the off chance that they might be in the same restaurant as a terrorist that we're out to get. And Kevin Drum, who's certainly one of my favorite webloggers, a person whose opinions I generally admire and agree with, he had a post I saw the other day where he talked about the evidence that a top Al-Qaeda operative, or at least some top Al-Qaeda officers, were in fact at this home that was destroyed by a remote missile by the U.S., by the CIA, basically. And that, if true, he said, you know, in his view, that made the attack justified, and he challenged readers who disagreed to explain why, or to explain under what circumstances an attack like that would be justified if they didn't feel it was justified in that case. You know, I didn't have an answer for that. Again, not having properly obsessed over the issue and actually gathered my data, you know, I really don't know. I don't know the details, and I don't even know that subset of the details that I might know if I had been looking into the story and reading all I could find about it on the internet. So, I don't really have good information on which to base an opinion. What I do have, in general, is this perspective that I'm talking about. And again, I'm kind of making a virtue of necessity. I think I'd be better off, in terms of a person making judgments about all this, if I was obsessively reading all the facts I could find, sifting them and comparing them one to another. But as long as I'm willing to accept a certain fuzziness as to detail, I do think that having stepped back from that subject matter a little bit puts me in a better position to again have some perspective and have a reasoned judgment on what my opinions are on all these issues. You know, again, not as to detail, but in terms of having a perspective from a greater altitude. You know, when I'm driving down the Ventura Freeway here, I have one perspective on what this area is like. And if I were flying at 10,000 or 30,000 or 100,000 feet above the ground looking down, as we all can now with, you know, the aerial satellite photography you can get on the web, I would have a different perspective. And some things I would see better, some things I would see more clearly, some things I would see less clearly. And I think, as long as you're aware of that, as long as you're aware of the difference between those two perspectives, that having that more distant perspective can give you a useful viewpoint and a useful source of understanding about the subject that you're examining. So, just thinking back on the last 5 years of the Bush presidency, I find myself, unsurprisingly, feeling that the big picture confirms my sort of gritty, close-up, detailed perspective. You know, Bush has basically shown himself to be incompetent, as he was with all previous high-profile undertakings he was involved with. He was basically incompetent as a student, he was incompetent as a Texas oil man, he was incompetent as a owner of a Major League Baseball team, and he was incompetent as governor of Texas. And, you know, he didn't change suddenly when he became president. He continued to be essentially the same kind of person he was. And that is a person who's not very reflective, a person who's not possessed of, you know, detailed knowledge. Here we are again talking about perspective. He's got bundles of perspective. He's got all kinds of perspective. But he doesn't have a whole lot of specific information to draw on, so that perspective ends up being more, in my view, it ends up being more about his own inner psychological needs, his own resentment over, you know, his overachieving father and his own relative lack of accomplishments, his own relative lack of ability. You know, George Bush Sr., or George H.W. Bush, I should say, was all about competence. It was all about, you know, yes, he had that patrician sort of blue blood heritage, but he was also someone who strove to better himself. And George W. Bush, if you look at his biography, has pretty much reacted in the opposite direction. You know, his whole life has been a story of pugnaciously asserting that he's just as good as the next guy in spite of the available evidence, which suggests over and over again that, well, actually, no, he's not quite as good as the next guy, which would be fine for most people, but for him, it's not. You know, for him, he has to go out there and assert that, no, he's just as good as everybody else. And as proof, he points to his position. As proof, he points to the trappings of his office and, you know, the kind of guy he has become. You look at, you know, people are born with one set of attributes, and then those attributes are molded by their childhood. And I think by the time they hit adulthood, they're pretty much set. You know, you've got one kind of person or another. And I think we know now very clearly the country has learned what kind of person George Bush is. And you see the steady descent of his approval ratings as indication of that. You know, even people who don't pay a whole lot of attention and never did pay a whole lot of attention, who are inclined to give him the benefit of the doubt because he seemed to hold, and in some cases may well actually hold, views that they share. Still, as they've seen more and more of him, seen him in action, seen the results of his decision-making, they come to the conclusion that, yeah, he's really not very good as president. And in the wake of 9/11, you know, you had this tremendous challenge because you had, I mean, I think anybody looking at George Bush's history could have predicted that he would screw up at some point during his presidency, but I don't think anybody would have predicted that he would have screwed up so spectacularly that early in his presidency. That is, with the whole, you know, downgrading of international terror as a threat and moving resources in the Justice Department away from anti-terrorism in favor of things like cutting down pornography, which John Ashcroft felt was a much higher priority. And, you know, in the international level, moving away from work, doing the hard work of international diplomacy to avoid the problem of failed states and breeding grounds for international terror. And instead, they reverted to focusing on the same problems they'd been working on in the first Bush administration, you know, sort of anti-Soviet containment issues and Iraq. And we saw the results of that. You know, they missed the 9/11 attacks, despite plenty of evidence that should have given them a much higher degree of concern. And so in the wake of it, you know, we launched this metaphorical war on terror that was quickly morphed into a literal war on Iraq, and we're left with the consequences of that to this day. All the people who advised Bush that it was a mistake, that there were potential downsides he wasn't considering, people like Colin Powell with the, you know, you break it, you own it warning, people like Chirac, president of France, with his advice to be careful about this, that you were, you know, that France had experience with this, with their own situation in Algeria. And, you know, he was saying, look, it's not going to be easy. You're going to go in there, and the initial invasion isn't going to be the hard part. The hard part's going to be the aftermath, and you're going to have very few options, and they're going to just get worse. And Bush ignored that advice, as he's really good at doing. He's excellent at ignoring advice and going his own way. And he ignored the advice of his own father, who, amazingly, you know, it kind of got buried in all the other big news going on in the run-up to the invasion in early 2003, late 2002. But Bush's own father basically went public advising him to be cautious, to not give in to his emotional impulses to go after Saddam Hussein, and to listen to the wiser heads around him. And of course, Bush ignored that too. And in retrospect, that may well have been just adding more fuel to the fire. Having his dad advise him not to do something probably is from what I know of his biography, that's a red flag waved in front of a bull. And George Bush charged right in and took us with him. Speaking of charging bulls, one of the things I've been using my commute time for is listening to podcasts, and one of the ones that has remained, you know, there was a flurry where I went out and I just grabbed every podcast I could find, or every highly rated or even not so highly rated podcast that seemed on the face of it to have some potential. And, you know, I've listened to them all over the past few weeks and weeded myself down to a much smaller number that I actually continue to like listening to. One of my favorites is The Hollywood Saloon, where Andy Seams, I want to say, and John Jansen, a Texan and a former Texan who are obsessed with movies and movie making, they share their thoughts on Hollywood and different movies. And, you know, it's a podcast, it's amateurish, but theirs is certainly on a more, it's more professionally produced than the large majority of podcasts I listen to. Andy takes the time to put a lot of sound effects, and I assume it's Andy doing this work, a lot of sound effects and clips from movies and movie trailer soundtracks, things like this in the background. And it's cute, and, you know, their opinions are fun to listen to. And they talk for a long time, which really helps. You know, when you've got an hour and a half each way when I've got an hour and a half each way on my drive, I don't want these 15-minute podcasts. I use them up, toss them aside like a Kleenex. I need big, brawny, paper towel, soak them up podcasts to use up that drive time. So I've been listening to them and their views on movies. You know, my opinions and theirs are not completely in sync. I'm one of the large majority of people who really hated the third Alien movie, Alien 3, whereas they both liked it. But, you know, hearing them talk about it and why they liked it in their whole masterclass podcast on David Fincher, the director of Alien 3, you know, I found myself thinking, I gotta go watch that again. There's something there. I'd be interested in watching it just to see the things they describe. Another movie that I saw, largely because of their gushing about it, was Man on Fire, the Tony Scott-directed Denzel Washington movie with Dakota Fanning, where he's basically a counterinsurgency expert slash hitman trying to go straight, down on his luck and drinking a lot at the beginning of the movie, who gets work as a bodyguard for this little girl, this little 11-year-old girl in Mexico City. And, you know, I won't. If you haven't seen it, it's worth seeing. You know, I ended up coming away from it saying, you know, that really, there were some neat things there. I do appreciate the stuff that John and Andy talked about, Tony Scott's editing style and his quick cuts and some of the, you know, very high-energy sort of sequences he puts together. And that was interesting. You know, I'm not a big Tony Scott fan. He's certainly a step above Michael Bay, but to a degree, he has the same sort of, I don't know, loud noise for its own sake kind of thing going on. Well, that's not fair. Michael Bay has it in spades, and Tony Scott has it a little bit with a lot of other more interesting things going on. But in any event, ultimately, the movie was a little bit dissatisfying for me. Man on Fire, I'm saying. Denzel Washington's performance was great, and Dakota Fanning's performance was great. You know, a lot of the actors had very good performances in it. Christopher Walken, you know, was really good. And the heart of the movie's interest is this whole, you know, basically how after Dakota Fanning is kidnapped, and Denzel Washington's character is shot in the course of the kidnapping, although he, you know, manages to kill four or five of the kidnappers. He then goes on this mission of revenge. He goes on this mission of retribution. He goes after them and And really, again, at the heart of the movie is the way that Denzel Washington, as he gets hold of these people in this ring of kidnappers and follows the chain one by one, he basically takes them and tortures them and tortures information out of them. And it's the very coldly dispassionate, you know, almost friendly approach he takes as he's torturing them. And I'm thinking of the one scene in particular where he's got the bad guy in the car with his hands duct taped to the steering wheel. You know, it's powerful stuff as movies go. And I, like I say, I watched the whole movie. You know, I didn't finish it that night. I got up the next morning and watched the rest of it because I wanted to see how it ended. Ended up feeling a little dissatisfied in that the big plot twist at the end was really telegraphed. And maybe it's not fair for me to hold that against the movie, but I thought it was pretty obvious, you know, well in advance where it was going with that twist. But it you know, did deliver it. There's sort of a straight ahead aspect to it that, you know, I like my movies maybe a little more ambiguous. I like them a little more. I like more subtlety. There was character in this movie, certainly, and story. I like movies, you know, I prefer movies where the character is a little more upfront. For movies that are really plot driven like this one was, I'd like it if the plot was a little less obvious, you know, a little more intellectual engagement, not so much just visceral engagement and big explosions. But for what it was a good movie, and I enjoyed watching it. Another movie I haven't seen, but I'd like to see, and I'm looking forward to seeing, is Matador, a new movie with Pierce Brosnan, where he basically plays an older, slower, more tired version of his James Bond. And that just sounds like a lot of fun. Sounds like a really interesting film, and I look forward to seeing it. I watched most of the Golden Globe ceremony the other night, which is always fun. I mean, it's fun for the acceptance speeches. It's fun for, you know, hearing the clinking of silverware and plates as the wait staff is furiously bussing the tables while the star is up there getting ready to begin his or her acceptance speech. And the speeches themselves, you know, are usually a big cut above the Oscar speeches. You don't have the constant intrusion of the orchestra telling them to hurry up and finish. You know, at the Golden Globes, the acceptance speeches are the show. You know, it's not so much that they have to hurry those people off the stage so they have time to do their production numbers or their big movie retrospectives or their special awards or what have you. No, you're there to hear the acceptance speeches. And you know, interesting things happen at the Golden Globes acceptance speeches. We had the wonderful event a few years ago where Ving Rhames won the Golden Globe and was, you know, talking about the honor and respect he had for having been nominated alongside someone like Jack Lemmon. And he asked Jack Lemmon up on stage, and then when Jack Lemmon got there, he gave that great line about, you know, how you're wealthy according to the value of the things you can give away. I forget what the exact words were. It was much more eloquent than I just said, but he basically said, "And I'm giving this to you," and handed him the Golden Globe. That was a fun moment. So you got to get your stars liquored up. You got to have them out there drinking wine for an hour or so, and then you get some good acceptance speeches. You know, Jon Stewart should have a word with the Oscar people as he's preparing for his own hosting of the upcoming Oscars telecast. Get those stars boozed up a little bit. We'll get better acceptance speeches. I really like Hugh Laurie's acceptance speech for House. House MD is one of the few TV shows that I've actually allowed into my life. You know, I tend to have this high barrier that I keep between me and the TV shows I'll watch. My wife is really into Boston Legal lately, and my daughter Julia also, and they say, you know, why don't you like that? Why won't you watch that show? And, you know, I watched a few of the episodes, and I liked them. They were fun. Especially like, you know, William Shatner is the sort of aging, you know, Kirk as aging lawyer persona that he plays, which is cute. But, I don't know, I just, you know, I don't have room in my life for another TV show right now. And what room there is taken up by House MD. You know, I went and caught a few of the first season's episodes on reruns, and then Netflix, the first season's DVDs, and watched all of them. And I've been following the second season as Fox sort of teases us with an episode here, and then a break, and then another episode a month later. And there are things I like better and about the show, and things I don't like as much. But overall, I like it a lot. And, you know, Hugh Laurie is really the heart of it. I've been a Hugh Laurie fan for a number of years. Going back to Jeeves and Wooster, and also his performances in any number of period dramas and sort of that, you know, that Brit romantic comedy genre. But his acceptance speech was great, where he basically came out and said, "Well, you know, I made a list of the 120 people who've worked on this show who I owe profuse thanks to, but I don't have time to thank them all, so I've written all their names down on slips of paper, and they're in my pocket. I'm going to pull out three at random and thank them, which he then proceeded to do. And it was a cute bit. My wife noticed, you know, Stephen Fry sitting next to him, congratulating him as he went up to accept the award. And her opinion is that Stephen Fry helped him with that, and I wouldn't be surprised if that's true. A lot of my available attention these days is devoted to my new job, you know, learning about how their systems are set up, learning a lot about having a big, complex website based on Mason, which is a technology I haven't used much before. You know, I joked in my interview, they asked me if I had experience with Mason or if I knew much about it, and I said, well, you know, really, pretty much everything I know about Mason is what I've learned in boning up for interviews with companies that use Mason, but having never previously been hired by one, you know, I didn't know that much about it. I mean, I knew the basics, and apparently that was sufficient for them, because they went ahead and brought me on board. But so there's been a lot of learning on my part, just in, and you know, this website I'm working on, it's got 5 years of steady development, and that means layer upon layer upon layer of hacks and shortcuts and weird little convoluted things that, you know, if you were there for the 5 years they're being created, you know it all intimately, and you can be relatively efficient in terms of going in and making changes and fixing bugs. You know, for me, every trip into that code is still something of a trip into the wilderness, and you know, I'm getting my bearings a little better now. There's some things I can whip out pretty quickly. You know, once I've been through something in the code and understand what's going on, and things are clicking into place faster. Still like to be working more quickly, but anyway, that's where a lot of my available brain power is being devoted these days, is that kind of thing, which isn't necessarily of any interest in terms of things I can talk about in a podcast. Or maybe it would be, I don't know. But it would be of interest to probably a different audience from those who visit lies.com. But something I have been doing lately that, you know, one other small source of information that I have is bedtime reading. You know, I get that cherished half hour, 45 minutes after I go to bed where I sit there and read whatever book I'm working on. And that's something that I haven't given up. So that's nice to still have that. Lately, I've been reading a book that was a present from my sister-in-law, Mary, for a Christmas present, and a very nice Christmas present. The book, The Grail Bird, by Tim Gallagher. It is an account by Gallagher of his obsessive pursuit of the ivory-billed woodpecker. You know, this bird that I've talked about previously, and in fact, I think I talked about it in my first lies.com podcast, and I've talked about it on the site. I mentioned it just a few weeks ago in pointing to the top cryptozoology stories of 2005, where the number one story was the rediscovery of the ivory bill. But the book is actually really interesting. Gallagher's an excellent writer, and the story is really a fascinating one as he takes you through. You know, he's editor of a birding magazine published out of Cornell. He's not an ornithologist himself, but he's an avid birder. And for whatever reasons, you know, he had this obsessive interest in the ivory-billed woodpecker. The last well-documented, you know, the last previous well-documented sightings of ivory-billed woodpeckers in the U.S. were in the, I believe, the 1940s. And, you know, as of 10 years ago, pretty much every birding authority in the U.S. had concluded that they were extinct. You know, this was a big bird, it was an obvious bird, it was something that, you know, if they were out there, they figured people would be seen. And, of course, as we all learned in this past year, they weren't extinct, and they aren't extinct. There's at least a few individuals that have been seen in the last couple of years in the woods in Arkansas. And Tim Gallagher was one of the people who basically brought that, who made those initial sightings, or was there early on in terms of those sightings, and helped to bring it to the knowledge and of the authorities. And there's a great passage in the book where, well, I'll get to the great passage, but which is, of course, the discovery of the bird and the immediate aftermath. I mean, his first sighting of the bird in the aftermath. But he talks about his history of, you know, researching the bird and crisscrossing the area and talking to these people who had reported sightings. Because that, to me, this is the most interesting message from the book. It's not that, you know, the last ivory bill was seen in the 1940s and then no one ever saw another one until all of a sudden somebody saw one in 2004. No, people were seeing ivory-billed woodpeckers during that time. It's just that no one believed them. And there's really an important message there. And no, I'm not saying that, you know, people who are into cryptozoology are universally correct. I'm not saying that every conspiracy theory is correct. Most conspiracy theories are just conspiracy theories, and people are right to, you know, belittle them and poo-poo them as theories, if not, you know, being right to poo-poo the people who hold them. But the fact is, though, that buried in all those conspiracy theories, buried in all those, you know, laughably low probability assertions are some unlikely truths. I don't think that Bigfoot is real. I don't think that the Loch Ness Monster is real. But the ivory-billed woodpecker was real. And people who basically lumped the people reporting having seen ivory-billed woodpeckers together with the people reporting having seen Bigfoot or the Loch Ness Monster were wrong. They were mistaken. And it's important to me to remember that you can be wrong by being too cynical, just as you can be wrong by being too trusting. And I think people forget that sometimes. Certainly the people who dismissed the reports of these people who claimed to have seen ivory-billed woodpeckers. Tim Gallagher went and tracked these people down during the 1990s and, you know, early aughts, whatever you call the years after, between 2000 and 2010. He tracked some of these people down, people like Mary Scott, a couple of other people, people who had basically claimed to have seen ivory-billed woodpeckers and were dismissed by the experts. You know, oh, they must have just seen a pileated woodpecker. Or, oh, they must just be, you know, searching for recognition. But among those stories were clearly some where those explanations did not fit. This one in 1971, where this guy took two sort of Instamatic snapshots of ivory-billed woodpeckers on the trunks of trees, and turned those photos over to a friend of his, who was in fact a prominent ornithologist, who brought those photos to the meeting of the American Ornithological Union and was basically laughed out of the meeting and ended up dying an embittered man because no one would believe his story. And, you know, if you look at those photos, it's obviously, I mean, if you're, you know, reasonably expert at birds and you look at those photos, it's obvious that it's either a real ivory-billed woodpecker or it's someone intentionally faking an image of an ivory-billed woodpecker. So that was the position that these experts took. Oh, these are intentional fakes. But the reasons they offered for believing them to be intentional fakes were really weak. You know, the person involved did not come forward and identify himself publicly. He didn't identify where the shots were taken. So if the reason he's doing it is for recognition, well, it doesn't fit. You know, why would he have remained anonymous? And the things they pointed out, you know, that the posture of the birds were so similar in the two shots was obviously a stuffed bird that had been mounted on the tree. Well, yeah, woodpeckers have a certain characteristic posture, and they assume that posture when they're clinging to the side of a tree. You don't tend to see them in any other postures. You know, that the shots didn't show the bird's beak or didn't show the bird's feet. You know, that's the position the bird was in. You know, these are snapshots. This wasn't some, you know, expert photographer in a blind with a 400-millimeter lens spending days at a time snapping the perfect shot of these birds. This was a hunter in the Louisiana woods with an Instamatic on his head, walking slowly towards the birds, snapping pictures. And that kind of brings up, you know, this other aspect of the story, the fact that they were so skeptical. I know how it is for birders, that birding as a pursuit, certainly since it's moved beyond its roots where identification was made, you know, along the barrel of a shotgun, back in the Audubon days when you shot a bird and that's how you identified it. You know, there's a certain degree of subjectivity and there's a certain degree of rigor, of sort of scientific objectivity and skepticism that birders have to bring to their identifications. And it's appropriate for birders to be skeptical. Hey, there goes a marsh harrier. As I'm talking about birding, I see a harrier flying over this channel near Magoo Rock. Anyway, sorry, little stray birding for you there. There's an appropriate skepticism that expert birders bring to assertions of people seeing rarities, and certainly claims to have seen an ivory-billed woodpecker would have to rank at the top of assertions deserving of skepticism. But at the same time, you have to recognize that, you know, I mean, I've hung out with expert birders and I've gone out on trips with them a lot in my life, and, you know, there's a certain approach that most of these people tend to take. They go out there in the field in their hip boots or whatever, and they go tromping through the brush, and they make their pish calls to get the birds to move in the thickets, and they look at them and they spend, you know, half hour or an hour, and then they tromp on to the next area. You know, they're not stealthy for the most part. And what a typical avid birder thinks of as stealthy is not stealthy by wildlife observing standards. And that's why I think, you know, for a bird that's overtly, you know, that's known to be shy, that even historically when there were a lot more of them was talked about as a very shy bird, a bird that avoids human beings and lives in deep, remote woods, your chances of seeing that as a conventional birder are essentially zero. You know, anytime you walk into that forest, every shy, aware creature in that forest within, you know, several miles of your position knows where you are. And if they want to avoid you, which ivory-billed clearly do, they will successfully avoid you. People who are going to see ivory-billed woodpeckers were people like hunters and fishermen who would penetrate these habitats and sit down or even camouflage themselves and remain silent and motionless for hours at a time. And these people eventually, in rare cases, would have an ivory-billed woodpecker fly past them, and they would see them. And this happened. This happened over and over again. You know, in Gallagher's book, he recounts at least a half a dozen sightings that he considers credible. And certainly in light of the subsequent rediscovery of the bird, you'd have to, you know, agree that they're credible sightings. And they almost all follow the same pattern. You know, it wasn't a renowned birder in the woods who saw these things. It was some, you know, NRA member shotgun-toting duck hunter in the middle of the woods. And those are people that are easily dismissed by avid birders. And again, they were wrong. So it's exciting to me to know that ivory-billed woodpeckers exist. One of the things I've been using my drive time for when I'm not listening to podcasts or recording podcasts is playing these really great recordings that were a present from my other sibling-in-law, my brother-in-law, Dick, my wife's brother. He gave me three really great sets of CDs of Western bird calls. So I've been working on improving my bird identification by ear, something that I've always enjoyed doing, and now have the chance to really work on and bring to a new level. So I think I'm going to go do some of that now. Thank you for listening. This has been another Lies.com podcast, a little more rambling and disjointed than usual. I'll see if I can't work up something a little more organized for next time. This podcast is copyrighted and distributed under a Creative Commons license. See my website at www.lies.com/podcast for more about that. And once again, I am John Callender, and once again, thank you very much for listening.